How much to the Buddha? How much to the Dharma? How much to the Sangha? So part of this talk is going to be me sharing about a nonviolent direct action that I participated in this week. A bunch of us occupied Governor Brown's office in the Capitol, Salem, demanding that she come out against the Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas project, which is happening, or we like to say, we're trying to say, is not going to happen in Southern Oregon. I will describe a little bit more about that later, but I want to make it clear that I am excited about it and would love to just go on and on about it, but I wouldn't take up the space of a Dharma talk to do that. I'm not doing it in order to impress you that I participated in this. I mean, I've gotten people via email or Facebook going like, right on, and that's fine, but like that's not why I did it, and it's certainly not a reason to talk about it. It's actually kind of a reason not to talk about it, but and I'm not doing it in order to recruit anybody to do actions like I'm doing or whatever. And I'm not insisting in any way or implying any way that you agree with me, you agree with my views on things, or even on Jordan Cove, or that you approve of nonviolent direct action or anything. Zen is about freedom. It's about taking responsibility for ourselves and doing our own practice. So that's the last thing we want to do, is to create some kind of dogma, even if we think it's good dogma, that everybody is supposed to accept. So go out to lunch and debate freely. Instead, I want to share about this because, as many of you know, I've been kind of struggling with this whole issue my entire life, and especially over the last few years. And it's starting to take shape in my mind and heart. And so what I want to present today is the idea of the climate and ecological emergency as a koan. As a koan that we not just can wrestle with in our Zen practice, but actually we have no choice. We're facing this koan. But how do we see it that way? So let's see. So a koan is there's different definitions of it, but the way that it is used in Zen, a koan is I guess I would call it an obstruction. It's an obstruction somehow of our action, of our freedom, of our happiness, of our ease, or something. It's an obstruction that we're coming up against. And it may be a question that we don't feel we know the answer to. It may be confusion. It may be inhibition, discouragement. It's a point of growth or learning. It's that what we often, sometimes we say, it's the edge of our practice. And this barrier, we want to pass through this barrier. That we want an answer or a solution or a response. But this kind of barrier or obstruction does not involve an answer. There's two different kinds of problems: convergent and divergent. So convergent problems are like, there's an answer. There's a mathematical problem, and you're going to find out, what is the answer, or what is the chemical code of this, or what is the cure for cancer, or use your powers to zero in on the answer that's going to be the solution. But in divergent problems, like communicating well with your partner. I mean, there's no like one answer you're going to get to that. It's something that has to be lived. So the answer to a divergent problem has to be lived. So this is what koans are these obstructions that we encounter that we have to live the answer. It's even if we have some kind of intellectual understanding of it, doesn't necessarily get us through the obstruction. So in Rinzai Zen, they have a formal koan curriculum. So they have these teaching stories, these kind of obscure sounding teaching stories, interactions between teachers and students, and they present something and you go like, what? And then you're supposed to sit with this koan and like, what is that? I mean, so in a way that in itself is an obstruction. It's like, what am I, I'm supposed to illustrate my understanding of this, but what does that even mean? How would I even do that? So it's kind of an artificially created system of obstructions to bring you face to face with things. And in Soto Zen, we say, and I mean, there's strengths to both systems. We say the koan arises in everyday life. So in order to make those Rinzai koans meaningful, you have to make them personal. You have to find a way that this evokes a point of obstruction in you that you need to wrestle with. And our way is instead you have these obstructions that we encounter in life, and then we say, how is that a koan? And so, you know, that's not necessarily the easiest thing to do. And sometimes we just want the obstructions to go away instead of engaging them as a koan. But I feel like the essential message of koans is that there is a payoff to wrestling with these obstructions. Like, liberation lies on the other side of these obstructions. That you know, they're not just things to be like, you know, dealt with or endured, but if we engage them in the right way, we learn, we grow, we overcome inhibitions and fears and all kinds of things. So there's great, so that we encourage you to wrestle with koans. So in the sense, the climate and ecological emergency that we're facing is we can engage with as a koan. There's all kinds of ways that we're coming up against this. How do we respond to the emergency? I mean, how do you arouse a sense of emergency when like you can only really sustain a real sense of panic and emergency for like maybe 24 hours or at the most? And like, I mean, what is being asked of us? What is the appropriate relationship to this situation? What is authentic? How do we avoid despair and overwhelm? How do we follow our conscience without causing disharmony within our relationships and families, communities, and country? How do we still have some access to joy and appreciate our lives if we're, you know, trying to address, you know, awful things? What can we actually do as individuals with little or no power, as we usually think of it? You know, what is power? How do we take it back? And these are, of course, they're questions that we can contemplate and read about and think about and talk about and debate and whatever. But when we engage this as a koan, we're going to have to live an answer, live a response. It's going to be something that we enact, something we actually do or refrain from doing, or something is going to be about our real life. So to go a little bit more into illustrating that by going into a particular example. So my point, before I go into the particular example, is that responding to our ecological and climate crisis is not just a matter of practical necessity moral obligation, civic responsibility. It's an opportunity to more fully awaken. In other words, response is not an adjunct to our Zen practice. And I looked up adjunct, a thing added to something else as supplementary rather than the essential part. So it's not an adjunct to our Zen practice. It is inseparable from our Zen practice. We're facing this koan whether we like it or not. I mean, I realize people in this room may be in different states of being self-informed about all of this, but the list of disturbing things goes on and on and on. Like, koalas may just have functionally become extinct because of the bushfires. Their population was low enough, their habitat was low enough that they probably are not going to be able to survive as a species. Food production, it's the unpredictable weather. Farmers everywhere, including Sato, my Dharma sister who runs the organic farm. Their farm was in the red this year for the first time. You know, it's just the approaches are not working. And, you know, as we know, there's an influx of migrants at our southern border because they're not being able to raise food the way that they used to. So, you know, there's all kinds of crises which we are going to be dealing with and facing. So whether we like it or not, just as we eventually face the koans of loss, change, illness, death, here's this koan. And what's especially important about this koan is that we're facing it together. We all have this koan, like the same koan at the same time. And what really could be more appropriate and timely? After 100 years of an industrial growth society, we've become highly individualistic, divided, isolated from one another. Our community bonds and structures have been weakened or destroyed. So part of the climate crisis koan is also challenging us to find ways to come together. So that's the kind of thing that points to, you know, engaging this obstruction as a koan, as an opportunity, is not just about like, oh crap, look at this thing we have to face. It's there will be growth and reward on the other side, or in the process. So I'm just going to share about, you know, my engagement of this koan, one aspect of it, one recent aspect of it, and then I'll reflect on why it's relevant. But I can give you the gist of it, is that that our response is lived, so it involves our body, heart, and mind. So our mind, you know, is like, what do we think about it? What are our opinions? What's right and wrong? How would we get out of this? I mean, you know, our minds are engaged, but our real response to this is going to involve our body and our heart. So I hope you don't mind me sharing, Ruth Ann, but yesterday at the term student, this example I'm thinking of, so I'm going to talk about this direct action thing, right? But I just thought another way, so Ruth Ann talks about trying to minimize use of the dryer. So she's got a big, got an apartment downtown with a big window, and she dries her clothes on a clothesline, right? And just realizing, you know, the neighbor across the way can look in and see her laundry hanging there. But that's like, that's what this kind of response is. This is like, as you're making this decision, or as you're in the restaurant and you're ordering something vegan instead of, you know, using animal products or something. I mean, this is something you're enacting as a response in your body, heart, and mind. So all of my life, I have been attracted to, inspired by by nonviolent direct action. I've never participated in it before this week. But I've I've always been fascinated by Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi and, you know, just like, wow. So what is direct action? I am going to let Martin Luther King tell us. So this is from his letter from Birmingham jail. He says, you may well ask. So this is a letter to fellow, particularly to fellow clergy who have a problem with the way that he's going about things. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community that has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. My citing the creation of tension as part of the work of the nonviolent resistor may sound rather shocking, but I must confess that I am not afraid of the word tension. I have earnestly opposed violent tension, but there is a type of constructive nonviolent tension which is necessary for growth. Just as Socrates felt it was necessary to create a tension in the mind of an individual so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myths and half-truths to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, so must we see the need for nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. The purpose of our direct action program is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. So, on Thursday, there was a rally at the Capitol. It was in asking Governor Brown to come out in opposition to the Jordan Cove project, which is, I am embarrassed to say, I was not even really aware of. I mean, I'd heard the name before. I was not aware of the issue until essentially I got the notice that there was going to be this nonviolent direct action. And then I did the research, and then I was like, oh my. So there, I mean, from my point of view, there's just so much wrong. There's just so much wrong with this project. So this is a Canadian company that wants to extend a pipeline all the way across southern Oregon to pipe fracked gas taken from Colorado and Canada, pump it to Coos Bay, where it will be a liquefaction plant, which then loads it into ships and ships it to Asia for sale. So a Canadian company will be making the money, and the gas will go to Asia and drive up the price of gas, probably for the rest of us. Now, the argument the company is making is that natural gas is a clean burning fuel, so it's a good alternative. But what you don't take into account is all the processes, pumping, using up all of our water to get the fracked gas out of the ground, and the processes of, like, I guess you have to make it into some kind of, I mean, the pipeline, other pipelines break and like an awful oily slurry comes out. If something happens to a natural gas pipeline, it explodes. So this explosive pipeline is going to go through 200 plus miles of tribal lands, national forests, state forests, and private land. So ironically, this is bringing together a lot of different varied kinds of people, like ranchers and farmers and, you know, who are like, because they're going to take that land through the process of eminent domain, which is can only be done if the government decides this is in the public interest. And so this company is trying to get the government to say this is in the public interest so we can just come into your land and build this pipeline across it. Because, you know, natural gas is cool and, you know, it'll be an economic boon to the area, which is always the argument in this, right? There's going to be this big construction, lots of jobs. Of course, once the construction is done, at the very most, there'll probably be a few hundred jobs. So the cost to the community, plus once the fracked gas is, you know, once they've exhausted it, once the market is, you know, saturated, then they disappear. So like the economic boon is going to be very limited. And instead of, I mean, they're going to be given huge tax breaks. So they said, but instead what we'll do is make voluntary payments of like $12 million a year to Coos Bay. And then, you know, Coos Bay is, you know, now there's all this publicity around like all these wonderful things we're going to do with this $12 million a year. But essentially the company is just buying off the community in order to get this through. So anyway, and besides, and then there's all that. Plus, this is just like 180 degrees from the direction we should be going in terms of, you know, getting off of fossil fuels, right? so we wanted to ask Governor Brown to take a public stand against this. Not that she can necessarily single-handedly shut it down, but Governor Inslee has taken a stand against a fracking plant in Washington, and there's another governor, I think, in New York who's taken a public stand against projects. So we're asking her to use her wherewithal, plus this fact that she does sit on the Oregon State Land Board, and this project will still need some state permits to go through. So there's this rally outside the Capitol, and, you know, there's a few hundred people there and cheering, and fortunately it wasn't raining. very moving, and we got banners and all that. And that, honestly, like, those kinds of things, they matter, but if any of you have been to rallies before, it's like, you know, they take a lot to organize, and there's, like, their little blip, and they're kind of easily ignored, you know. Those who are there feel a little empowered, but, you know, what does that mean? But what we did was process into the Capitol, and I'm hopefully going to show you some pictures. Singing a song all together. There was probably over 300 people there, and into the Capitol Rotunda, and there was this, the sound echoes beautifully in there. So it was really moving, and then a whole bunch of us went up the stairs and went into Governor Brown's ceremonial office, which is, you know, up on the second floor, and occupied it for over 8 hours and refused to leave until Governor Brown came out against the pipeline. She gave us a call at one point. She was in Eugene, conveniently. So she wasn't at the Capitol that day. So she gave us a call, but they put her on speakerphone, and she answered some of our, you know, some of the spokespeople talked to her. And of course she gave, you know, there's a process for this. I'll make sure laws are followed. One of her big things, which is very admirable, is she will be fighting for states, the right of states to control these kinds of things and not let the federal government just ram them through, which is something the Trump administration is trying to make happen. It's trying to take away the rights of states to say no to these kinds of things. So she's going to be fighting that, so that's great. But, you know, she basically did the whole political speak of like, her very, very brave chief of staff came in to talk to us several times. I admire him for doing that. So he came in and he was like, so how about, you know, Kate comes and talks to you guys in person and then you guys leave. and at first we're like, sure, yeah, she can come and talk to us. And he's like, and then you guys leave. She's like, well, and we're like, well, not if she doesn't come out against the pipeline. They're like, all right. But she did end up coming. She ended up being coming around 9 p.m., you know, standing there with a whole bunch of state troopers. And, you know, and she gave us the same deal. And she said, basically, you know, like, she doesn't want to, she says, you know, you guys have your opinion. There's other people who are for this, and, you know, their voice counts too, and I don't want to be seen as, like, putting my finger on the scale, right? Somebody did point out, well, you've come out, you know, for the I-5 bridge over the river. Like, you've come out for other things and put your finger on that scale in this case. And then my argument as well was like, well, you know, I don't think if we had just left it up to the majority that women would ever have the vote. I don't think that people of color would have any civil rights. If it was just like, well, there's people with, you know, they also have other opinions. And so we're going to have a process and it looks like they're going to decide that that's not going to happen. You know, that's what leadership is about. And anyway, so she didn't come out against it. And the cops then started giving us a warning because the building had closed at 5:30 that we need to leave. And so they gave us the kind of the final, like, all right, you better leave now. if you don't, you're going to be subject to arrest. And so up until that point, we were about 50 people. And then, you know, most people left and 21 of us decided we're staying. And so we kind of sat down on one side of the room. There's actually some video of this if you want to look it up online. And they were saying, and so he read us the formal warning, like, if you do not leave, you will be charged with criminal trespass too, and da, da, da. And then we all just, like, held hands and started to sing. And then the process of arrests started to begin. It took them quite a while. They picked us off one at a time. And there's a little song you sing as each person is being taken off. You go, like, let's see, there was a, like, dying, let's see. Oh, no, that's the other tune of the other song I'm going to sing. Anyway, there's this beautiful, sweet little tune where you just say, you are not going to stand alone. We will stand with you. And so as each person goes, you sing it for their name. And then, so a fellow Dharmarine Buddhist and I, were the last two people. I was wearing my priest robes. I think they just kind of didn't want to touch me. You know, I think they were just kind of like, they would come in and they'd just kind of be like, you know. So we were the last two, and they took us both at the same time. So it wasn't, you know, there wasn't just one of us like, you will not walk alone. probably for legal reasons, they took us both at the last, and, you know, put our hands behind our backs, tied them with these extremely uncomfortable zip ties, these big, beefy zip ties, and my arms started to go numb, and it was the most distressing part of the whole thing for me. The funny thing is then we all end up in a police van out front, so this was the rest took 2 hours, and we, you know, we're saying goodbye, and then we're all just in the van, oh, hi, you know, but as we came out of the Capitol, then there were people, we had a whole, like, support team, and they were waiting there in the freezing cold, and they would sing that song for us as we came out and cheered. So, like, you know, we had this support all the way, and then as we're locked up in the jail bus, going to the Marion County Jail, we knew, you know, they were following. They were going to be following our progress and ready to figure out what's happening to us and be there when we got out. So, yeah, we were booked into jail, stripped down to just one layer of clothing, not including your underwear. So this ended up in an evidence bag. I could have handed it off at the last minute, but I wanted this to go into an evidence bag. We were all, and the women were all, like, tiny little, like a quarter of the size of this, smaller. All 12 women were locked up in this concrete jail cell together, and it was like a kind of like a surreal slumber party. I mean, we're all really tired. It's the middle of the night, but we're all just kind of like, there were these five like mats on the floor, kind of grungy looking, covered with plastic. At least, you know, they were there. and we're all kind of, you know, drowsy and sitting around. And one part, I don't know if you've ever been to a march, but like one of the common chants is, "This is what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like." We're sitting there, and one of these women go, "This is what democracy looks like." And if we all laugh, like, "Yep, right now, this is what democracy looks like." That is all. They treated us well, and then, you know, by the end of the evening, so we all got released by 5 a.m. And we have a court date on December 20th. But I guess, you know, I just wanna share some of the, kind of the visceral aspects of this, kind of whatever you may think about the political things or the approaches or the whatever, you know, my own experience of living this response was incredible. And so I don't want to make light of, you know, the job losses that may come from phasing out fossil fuels, or I don't want to make light of arrest. It can be a very serious thing for certain people. So this isn't a lighthearted party. This isn't something to just like do for fun or something like that. And yet the like surprising rewards, the sense of, we really actually occupied the office for over 10 hours, including those of us that were arrested last. And the whole time, I mean, you would think it was hot and stuffy. I think they kind of deliberately made it hot. And, you know, you kind of ran out in the hall and used the bathroom and, like, hope they weren't going to close off the room before you got back, which at least they let us use the bathroom. But that whole time, I've never bored for a moment. I mean, we sang, we chanted. We went around the room and all 50 people said why they were there. You know, there was this sense of solidarity and purpose and connection. And, you know, those of us who have our court date on December 20th are like, what should we do afterwards? You know, we're all going to be together again. And just that sense of congruence between, you know, what I really believe, and what I was doing, what I was enacting with my body was, I don't know, it felt like a response to a koan. It felt like an obstruction that had been passed. And as I'm going to talk about more, like, you don't just, you know, pass one koan and then, like, that's it. Now everything's solved and that's good. I mean, you have to continue to live it. And the next answer might not be exactly like the first answer. But in order to make this kind of real, I did want to, I apologize for any awkwardness around technology. But takes a little while for that to heat up. I actually wanted to play you a video, but I can't get the videos to play. But I can show pictures, and then I can play you a little bit of audio, because the as the rally was singing this chant and coming into the atrium, that was the most like awesome, inspiring moment. Thank you. not the one that has the pictures. I can show you. Hold on. So unfortunately, if I play the video, it doesn't go to the projector. Yeah, I didn't wear red, but everybody was asked to wear red, just as, you know, sign of solidarity with no LNG. At some point, we may end up having to watch an ad. All right, so that's the one of the views of everybody coming into the. Okay, yeah. Okay, next thing is an ad, but I think I can just skip it. The outside stuff. Oops. So I'll leave it right there, and hopefully that will stay while I play you the audio. This is an ad.
Some things are too important to do yourself. Get customized security at your Xfinity store or online. And we're totally flexible. Simple, easy, awesome.
So, those of us who went up the stairs and occupied the office, you know, that's what we heard for the first part of our occupation, was just these hundreds of people in the atrium singing that. It was one of the most moving and wonderful experiences of my whole life. So we don't get to choose whether we try to pass this koan. But our practice is to recognize that the tension is there, and that our practice is to lean into it, to open ourselves to the question. And to make the question personal, heartfelt, embodied. To demand an answer to be determined to find a way to get past the obstruction somehow and to learn from it. And the answer, if you've done any koan work, the answer doesn't come easily, and it doesn't come right away. And it doesn't come through the ordinary, it doesn't come through ordinary means. It doesn't come the way that you expect. It's like, I don't know. And sometimes me may want the resolution or the answer so much, but it doesn't come. But if we say, keep going, you can do it. You. That's the nature of these obstructions, is that there is a way through and that there is a reward. So there's not a final answer. It won't be simple or one-dimensional. Your answer may not resemble my answer. Maybe it will. I'm happy to have you join me. I'm hoping to get more and more Buddhists on the front lines. Maybe you will work in community disaster preparedness. I think that could be a wonderful way for people to come together as communities and to face what's going on with their body, hearts, and minds. What's going to happen? How are we going to support each other when, for some reason or another, we lose power for a week? You know, so maybe you canvass your neighborhood for a candidate you really believe in. Maybe you work to strengthen our democratic institutions or other kinds of community bonds and structures. Or maybe you decide to become vegan. There were several people in our term student group that tried that this time. And it, you know, it's like, if we do it as this is part of our response, it really doesn't have anything to do with what other people should do, or pontificating to them, or a hope that somehow everybody's going to become vegan and the problem be solved. But by living part of your response, it inspires other people. It's like, really? I mean, Stephanie was talking about, she tried to go without animal products this term, and her little, you know, 3-year-old daughter, Angelina, she had made lasagna with meat for the whole family, and Stephanie was eating like rice and veggies. And Angelina had the lasagna and she's kind of poking at it, and then she's like, I don't want to eat meat. And so she had some rice and veggies instead. You know, so it's just like this, who knows who you're going to inspire. Who knows who? And you'll know if the response is right. You know, you'll feel it. It's just, it feels like being authentic, being less obstructed. So with that, I'll open it up to comments or questions. Yeah.
When is the decision on this going to be made?
Well, there's different stages, but the federal, I forget the name of it, I think it's referred to as FERC or something, is going to make the decision in February. And then supposedly they're going to need state permits as well. So it'll be dragged out. But the thing is, this project has been defeated multiple times already. It's been around for 15 years. So these poor landowners and tribesmen and local people have been fighting it for 15 years. And it just, like, it's a zombie. It just keeps on coming back. And I guess FERC, the Federal Energy Regulation Commission or something like that, I guess it's pretty much just like this rubber stamp agency that just, like, says okay to energy projects all over the place. And in the Obama administration, they actually turned this down. They said this is not in the public interest, which I guess is a sign of how bad this is, because they just never turned anything down. So the fact that they actually turned this down at one point is a sign. I mean, it's a foreign company that's shipping the gas overseas. Anyway, but given a new administration. I mean, that's one of the things Trump said from the beginning, is I'm going to make sure these things can go forward. So it's probably going to go forward. And there are some things, it's unfortunate, there's some kind of loophole, whatever, that they can go in and they can start clear-cutting on these properties right away, saying basically it's going to cost the company too much money to wait, you know, if these for the permits. So I don't know. We may we're hoping it won't, but it may turn into a Standing Rock kind of affair where, you know, you're really on the front lines in front of the bulldozers. But it was really inspiring because, you know, if you looked, you can find a description. I was surprised by this. The Statesman's Journal, the Salem paper, actually listed all 21 of us, our names, our ages, and where we were from. And it's a very inspirational, like, there were 20-year-olds, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70-year-olds. I mean, and from Portland and from Coos Bay and from all over the place. And the sit-in itself was really, I would say, kind of led. I mean, didn't really have leaders, but there were two Native American folks from Southern Oregon, one from California, but like the Klamath Basin is, you know, overlaps. And they were just really inspiring speakers and motivators, and they had come all this way to participate. And I was, I got up and talked at one point, and I said, I don't usually do this because I just cry. But I said something, and then Anna, the Native American woman, she got up and she said, you're like me. You really, you know, you feel it. And then she sang a Native song. She said, this is my crying song. And she sang it while crying. And I was like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. Did you know there was a crying song? That is so awesome. She's like, we have songs for everything. So, yeah.
Greta Thunberg reminds us to look to the science, and the science facts that the Canadian company are using are inappropriate, they're weak, they're incorrect, and they're the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if sometimes we're not sure and we don't know everything from the websites,
yeah.
You can send a small check to like Columbia River Keepers or any of these places, because we have to fight people in the courts.
Well, and there's just all kinds of amazing stuff being done out there that we can support directly or indirectly. There's the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. That they what they do is basically, you know, pro bono support people like myself who are going to have to, you know, face a court date. I mean, I have the financial resources, but many people don't. Yeah, there's like, you can contribute to funds to help pay people's, you know, court costs and whatever. You can kind of support these things from afar as well, so.
I'm curious if yeah. Such a fund exists for the folks who got arrested
as you. Yeah, I think there is. I think Franklin said he found it online, but yeah.
I have a book I'm reading actually about the thing, like you mentioned about if we lose power, like you referenced.
Oh yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
And I'm reading a book sort of about that. Called Tribe. Uh-huh. Max Bastinger, and I haven't finished it, so I can't say it's gonna be amazing. But if anybody wants to read it with me, it's really interesting because he talks about how, he's a reporter, so he was like reporting in the war in Sarajevo. I should warn you, it's like there's a lot of violence in it, but he writes specifically about how in these conditions of violence, it creates more social equality because people, like when you're all faced with the same threat, everybody bands together, and he writes about the communities that arise out of that. So it seems really relevant to what we're talking about last week and what you alluded to earlier.
Well, that's one of the things that I kind of hope will happen. I know Shoketsu has been involved in disaster preparedness stuff, and you know, I mean, to think, like, how would our community come together and support one another? I mean, we are spread out kind of wide. You know, a lot of this stuff needs to be focused in neighborhoods. But on the other hand, you know, it's not just a matter of physical support, it would also be a matter of moral support. So,
I want to share my question.
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking about these kinds of things for years and years and years. And I'm trying to understand how to be effective in change and how to court that kind of pressure that needs to happen for the resistance to actually succeed. I really have a question about how to do that with a global issue that we face, because the organization of that is, in many ways, to me, seems insurmountable. Because the organization, when you look back to Martin Luther King and the civil rights, from what I understand, his core circle of people had a master plan of how they were going to put pressure and exactly when and where throughout the country, throughout years, with a very deliberate sense of how they were going to do it. And my question is, how do we do that with a global problem that we... because in order for it to succeed, in my mind, it does have to be a global effort to resist. So that's where I left with that question.
I've been thinking about it for a long time as well, and really kind of like, well, I don't see any answers out there. Do I have to come up with an answer? I can't come up with an answer. But I am extremely encouraged by what I see happening out there, that there are movements rising up, and they are led by people who have experience in strategic, direct action, and it's not. Yeah, I mean, there's this action had people from four different major organizations plus people not associated with them. Portland Rising Tide is one that does direct action. And then I've been really, some people have heard me talk about Extinction Rebellion, which is one that is attracting quite a number of Buddhists, actually, because it has pretty compatible principles, and it's global now, and they have certain demands, which are that the government and media tell the truth about the crisis. Two, that they enact binding legislation to get us to net zero emissions. We say by 2025, which of course is a pipe dream, but that's what it should be. And three, that the course forward should be decided not by politicians, because they always have, they're beholden to donors and to lobbyists. And I mean, you just cannot trust them to make the radical changes necessary. So instead we rely on citizens' assemblies, which are like juries, which would be informed. A case would be made for both sides, and the people would decide. I'm sure it's not a perfect system. It's not simple, but it's far preferable than just begging and hoping for our politicians to do something.
What would I Google to get connected with some of that?
Look up Extinction Rebellion. I've started a West Side affinity group. We meet first and third Mondays over at Market of Choice in the room upstairs. I am very inspired by that. And I don't mean to imply that anybody else should be, or that it's a perfect organization or anything like that. But for me, I feel like, I mean, this is the thing, is you can't, that's what I feel like is really awesome about the time that we live right now, which is, it's a horrible time to live, but it's a wonderful time to live, because I've been waiting all my life to do this. Like, how do I respond? How do I bring my heart and my body into alignment? But the opportunity wasn't there. But because you can't go out and do this stuff by yourself. You can't be like a movement of one. It has to be. But now there's enough momentum, there's enough people that now we can join. So I think it's an awesome time to be alive.
I'm going to ride my bike now, too.
Yeah. there's an avid.
That's my little piece of that part of my bow.
And if we engage it.
We keep driving. Oh, sure, that's right.
Well, and if I would just love this idea that if we engage this as like, this is part of my personal response to the koan, as opposed to like, if I, you know, like, there's a sense of, like, obligation and moral purity we can get caught in with, like, oh, I should be vegan, and then I shouldn't fly, and then I should ride my bike, and then I should sew my own clothes, and I should, you know, I mean, you know, so, like, now I have to do everything, but, like, no, I mean, what peace do we want to enact and not have that be, like, well, now that I'm doing that, I don't need to care, right? Because as long as I'm a vegan, it's not my problem. It's like, that's just a piece of the response, but. Yeah.
I think something that we can do as Buddhists is, I think what we are facing is absolutely a global emergency. And I think our practices of being present and able to deal with discomfort is probably going to be the most important thing that each of us will bring to everyone and anyone. Mm-hmm. Because there is, you said a very good question, there needs to be a global plan. And there's a very small group of people that are going to have the power to make some changes that are awesome. I mean, we can't drive cars anymore. Cows are done. Like, there are so many things that are so clear that need to happen that once the planners really, really get how much of an emergency is, this is like you are in the ER. You're not in the ER. You had a heart attack and you can't get to the ER in time. It's just awesome how global it is. And so anything that starts to put pressure so that this becomes something that folks with power are actually going to do something. And they have to do it very soon.
My son said 20 years ago when he was in high school, it's not going to change until enough people are uncomfortable. Because people are just comfortable enough that they're not going to worry about it.
It's not until... I mean, California is right next door. It's not until wildfires whip through faster than people can escape that we go, dang, you know. I mean,
that's affecting them. I just moved here from California, and the thing that's affecting them more than anything is not the wildfires. It's the fact that this entire neighborhood, you have no electricity for 10 days. You cannot go charge your phone anywhere because everybody else doesn't have electricity. And then you get a notification and you're still not sure what to do. This is affecting people in power, which is great. They are starting to go, well, wait a minute.
I know all the
so
yeah.
No, it's like, I couldn't, you know, the stuff they're talking about. These are very privileged people that are going, I couldn't charge my phone for 4 days. And it's like, yeah, that's a poor thing.
But then we're also gonna have to come together, because if the measures that need to be taken are simply imposed from on high, people will not stand for it, and our society will fall apart. So, you know, we need to, like, there's those folks in Coos Bay that want that $12 million to help revitalize their community. They want the jobs. They want, you know, so, you know, we have to do some other kind of investment for them, I guess. They live in what they call the Saudi Arabia of wind. There's, like, an amazing opportunity for offshore wind power right in that area. So let's invest in that. You know, let's say, sorry, we got to stop this project, but we will invest in your community. You know, like, that unless we... You know, and that's where, like, racial justice and the inequality of, you know, nation, you know, the global South that's been eating it for ages, like, you know, we have to address, it's because it's a global issue. We have to address it in that way, and it can't just be done on the backs of the people that have already been carrying the burden. Okay, one more. We've already gone over. I know it's a.
In The Great Thirst, which was copyrighted in 2011, there was a politician in there from the House of Representatives. I don't remember his name. I think he was from Pennsylvania. He was in the House like 30 years, and he said, well, as long as you're on the Titanic, don't you want the best chair? And actually, I think the people in charge, like the big corporations, they have known this for a long time. And it's the divide and conquer. So don't join with each other. Get to know our neighbors. And I think we're all called, whatever our age group is, to be a spiritual warrior, because how else can we find the joy in the togetherness? And, you know, we can do that if we just put blinders on.
Thank you. All right, I just will make a formal.
Are we supposed to close today?
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to be here in 5 minutes.
All right, can we have another two people? Bruce and Linda.
Thank you.
Oh, and I have one more. If you need to leave, that's fine, but I do have a formal end to the Dharma talk. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all.
You can email me if you forget.